Да здравствует 60-я годовщина Великой Октябрьской социалистической революции! Да здравствует героический советский народ и его доблестные вооруженные силы! Слава Коммунистической партии Советского Союза, руководящей и направляющей силе советского общества! Ура!
Hello, comrades and friends. This is Back in the USSR on CFRU 93.3 FM. I am Siegfried, and it's good to be able to return to you after the enforced absence of a very poorly timed federal election campaign. As many of you will know, I was a candidate here in Guelph running for the Communist Party of Canada, and well, it was quite the campaign. We got decent media coverage, despite gatekeepers shutting us out of practically all the local candidates' debates. We still managed to reach more people than we did in 2019 and got more votes, even though the overall voter turnout was terrible, like really across the country. Our message that people's needs must always come before profit really resonated in the present political climate, and the Communist Party really gained ground across the country because of it, you know, earning more votes and supporters everywhere we ran candidates. I mean, it was pretty well universal. We made these kinds of gains all across the country. That was in Ontario or Manitoba, or like out east in Nova Scotia and Newfoundland, or in BC, you know, or in Quebec, all these places. You know, we were reaching more people, getting more votes, getting more supporters, and having our message resonate now more than ever. And or at least in recent memory, I think we had the best election result that we've ever had since, I think it was 1974 or something like that, just in this past election. It's incredible. And me and my comrades, we were able to do all this because we worked together. You know, we were a real team and we supported each other through all the challenges and difficulties. And it's really important to mention that because, I mean, there is a reason why I was able to put out so few episodes of this show in the first half of this year, because my mental health was absolutely shot. I was a mess. When the election was called in late August, I hadn't even gotten a chance to reconnect with my friends and loved ones in the wake of the lockdown. And I remember being so afraid in the first part of the campaign, you know, constantly worried that I'd fail to get enough signatures to get on the ballot and of letting everyone down. I mean, this year marks the 100th anniversary of the Communist Party's founding, and that happened here in Guelph. I mean, imagine how I'd feel about failing to get on the ballot here in the federal election in our centenary year. You know, in this town where we were founded. I mean, that would just be horrible. And I think that was kind of in the back of my mind as I was kind of, you know, all this pressure was kind of, I was putting all this pressure on myself. And I was really afraid of letting everyone down. Because it really came down to the wire. I think we more or less had 2 hours to go to get enough signatures before the deadline at the end of August. And we just made it. We just made it. And, you know, so there was a lot of stress. I could barely interact with anyone socially, which is kind of a problem when you're running in an election and trying to engage with potential voters. You know, it's kind of important to be able to interact with people. But I'm so happy to say that my comrades came through for me. Everyone who was a part of this campaign, everyone who supported me, everyone who was part of the team, you know, some of them came in from KW and other places outside of Guelph to help me out. Everyone was so understanding and supportive. And we were able to work out a division of labor, kind of, you know, whereby other candidates could handle the stuff that I didn't have the comfort level to take on. Like approaching strangers with election leaflets outside the Guelph Farmers Market, for example. Or buzzing property managers so that we could deliver leaflets to apartment buildings. You know, neither of those things I was really comfortable doing. But there were other people who were they were able to step up and assume that role. And so we were able to overcome those challenges as a team, as a community. And it was also absolutely amazing to connect with people who were voting communist for the first time and were supportive of my campaign. In the end, I mean, it was through the campaign and all the people who supported me that I was able to regain some of my self-confidence and work through a lot of my mental health challenges that I've been dealing with this year. And I'm so grateful to everyone. I mean, you know who you are. And I'm happy. I'm so happy to be part of an organization that takes mental health seriously and actually makes access to mental health care a central part of its political platform. That's very important to me, as I know it is for a lot of people. But I don't want to dedicate this whole show to the federal election. I mean, overall, the election was pretty stupid. I mean, it was totally unnecessary and led to no real changes in Parliament. And that seems to be the general consensus. But I want to focus on just a much more pressing, serious topic that has really... It doesn't get enough attention and has recently garnered attention just on the basis of like just how atrocious, how horrific this what I'm about to talk about really is, and just how like the like recent incidents of it have just become so extreme. I want to focus on the epidemic of sexual violence that exists in this country. It's really a topic that I've never properly delved into in the history of this show, and that really needs to change. When 1 in 3 women can expect to be sexually assaulted in her lifetime, we're talking about a truly horrific situation that has deep structural roots in capitalist society and settler colonialism. As of September 17th of this year, upwards of 8,000 students walked out of classes at Western University, University of Western Ontario in London, Ontario, to protest against sexual violence. This action took place after upwards of 30 women were drugged and sexually assaulted at a party in the Medway Sydenham Hall residence during the university's orientation week. I want to let that sink in for a moment. This is an absolute atrocity. A male student was even murdered after he apparently tried to intervene to stop it. This is what the students at Western were protesting when they walked out of classes chanting, "Stop this violence, no more silence." Absolutely horrific. But it has to be understood that drugging and sexual assault are common occurrences, not aberrations. There have been at least 4 reports of this happening at the University of Guelph so far this September, and there's no way of knowing what the true number is because most incidents don't get reported. Just like incidents of domestic violence and rape are underreported. The justice system in this country is not friendly to survivors. We're often not taken seriously or even re-victimized by the system, made more vulnerable by the system. This was pointed out by one of the speakers at the Solidarity Walkout at the University of Guelph this past Thursday, which I took part in. I was there. The speaker drove home the point that the cops don't prevent rape and sexual violence. They only come in after the fact with a response that is often itself abusive. And while the Solidarity Walkout in Guelph was nowhere near as big as the one in London, I mean, there were walkouts at other universities too, in solidarity with the students at, you know, in London and what they're going through. But it was still impressive. You know, the numbers were still impressive. And a lot of students turned up to say, you know, that sexual violence needs to stop and that survivors should be believed and supported. And I was happy to see that a decent number of men did show up, even though the crowd was still overwhelmingly made up of women. And another speaker at the rally, who was from Guelph Wellington Women in Crisis, focused on how men need to stand up and confront the sexual violence and rape culture that is pervasive on college campuses and throughout society. Toxic masculinity needs to be confronted by healthy masculinity whenever it shows its face. And while they didn't dwell on this point very extensively, it still really hit home for me. Being a male ally is hard. We're living in a patriarchal society that doesn't encourage men to take the voices and experiences of women seriously or challenge our friends when they engage in abusive actions. And I admit I've fallen short in the past and failed to stand up in situations where sexist behavior was being expressed by the men around me. But it's important to keep trying, keep caring, keep listening, keep asking for consent, always, always, always keep asking for consent. Consent is mandatory. And keep struggling for justice, safety, healing, and equality for women, including queer women, trans women, racialized women, indigenous women, and all women-identified people. Because the toxic situation that we see with regard to gender-based violence is no accident. It's no accident that indigenous women have been dehumanized and victimized to the extent that they have when settlers from Europe seized their lands, trampled on their ways, and confined them to the margins of society, of a society built on genocide. They were seen as obstacles to be broken down by violence. And the colonists benefited from their marginalization on reservations and their imprisonment in residential schools. Because the settlers were able to take everything. You know, the land, the resources, everything. Indigenous women continue to face violence and murder at a horrifically disproportionate rate because of what settler colonialism did to this land. And that's the truth. In patriarchal societies the world over, men benefit from the unpaid domestic labor that women engage in and are unwilling to are willing to use force in order to keep those benefits along with unrestricted sexual access to the women that they dominate. This patriarchal control of women by men arose alongside slavery and feudalism, in which lords and plantation owners controlled and exploited vast numbers of serfs and slaves for the sake of wealth and power. It's the same reason why capitalists exploit workers to this day. Wealth and power are not things that any ruling group gives up without a fight, whether in gender or in class terms, or in ethnic or in racial terms. Various oppressions intersect with one another. Race, gender, class, sexual orientation, ethnicity, etc. And all are based on keeping a certain group of people down so that another group may benefit from their oppression. I mean, those young men who drugged and assaulted those young women at Western knew what they were doing. I'm sure they felt powerful and in control. They were taking what they wanted and enjoying it, not allowing any lack of consent to stand in their way. They were being men, quote unquote, as they understood it. And this toxic masculinity must be opposed and defeated because it ruins far too many lives. Every woman who was targeted that night is going to carry this trauma with her for the rest of her life. And no one deserves that. It doesn't matter what they were wearing or what they said or did. As a communist, I take the struggle for women's liberation seriously. It is central to who we are and always has been. Every socialist revolution has elevated women, empowered them, and allowed them to seek out their potential in life while tearing down traditional barriers of patriarchy and class and racial oppression. Every socialist revolution has done this in a systemic way. I mean, for all the good work that women's shelters and organizations like Guelph, Wellington, Women in Crisis do in this society, they are few, they are far between, they are underfunded, and they are overly dependent on donations. Contrast this with the Federation of Cuban Women, which has branches in practically every neighborhood in Cuba, a reserved block of seats in the National Assembly, and has the power to intervene in cases of domestic violence and engage in prevention and harm reduction, as well as supporting survivors. That an abortion is universally available in socialist countries like Cuba, unlike in Canada, where the right to an abortion isn't even guaranteed under the law, and women have to rely on the legal void opened up by the Morgenthaler case in the 1980s. Because no government since then has had the courage to stand up and actually pass legislation that would actually guarantee a woman's right to choose and protect it and guarantee access to abortion throughout the country. I mean, Cuba has confronted patriarchy as a matter of national policy since 1959, since the revolution. And the results are plain to see. Women who have guaranteed access to housing, employment, medical care, education, and genuine political community support are unlikely to get stuck with an abusive partner or be vulnerable on the street at night. When women enjoy real self-determination. Real self-determination. They have real control over their lives. Society as a whole becomes a safe space for them. And that's when the real healing can begin. Throughout the election, the slogan of the Communist Party of Canada was "People and the planet before profits." And I believe that this is central to the struggle for women's rights as well. So long as society elevates exploitation above the needs of human beings, the vast majority of women are going to face oppression and abuse. Survivors will continue to be faced with an uncaring justice system, an injustice system and the insult of universities like Western appointing committees and task forces to make it look like they're doing something for the women who continue to face the same risks every day. You know, acting like task forces are somehow a solution. When what is needed is community, communication, accountability, justice, respect, consent, and love. The pandemic has shown us just how important these things are and how important it is that we build them. We build them up in our daily lives and organize and fight for them politically. You know, that we build supportive communities, that we protect each other, that we stand with each other, support each other. Women in Canada deserve all the guarantees that Cuban women currently enjoy. And we must fight for these fundamental rights to be realized by all. From affordable housing to abortion access to the right to walk safely after dark. Having individual women in positions of political power does not defeat patriarchy. Women as an organized whole must be empowered politically if patriarchy is to be overthrown. And this is what Cuban women have done to a remarkable extent since 1959. Community organizing, political mobilization, and the winning of concrete political gains that improve human life, improve the rights of women, that is what will counter and prevent sexual violence, not more police. While sexual crimes such as rape should be taken seriously and perpetrators punished, brought to justice, the real work consists of stopping those crimes before they even happen. Women have the right to live in peace, as does everyone. And that's the message that one of my positive male role models, the communist Chilean singer-songwriter, Victor Jara, that's the message he conveys in this song. It's called El Derecho de Vivir en Paz, the right to live in peace. Please stay tuned to Back in the USSR.
El derecho de vivir, poeta Ho Chi Minh, que golpea de Vietnam a toda la humanidad, ningún cañón borrará el surco de tu arrozal, el derecho de vivir. El lugar más allá del ancho mar donde revientan la flor con genocidio y napalm, la luna es una explosión que funde todo el clamor, el derecho de vivir en paz. Thank you. explosión que funde todo el clamor, el derecho de vivir en paz. Dio con nuestra canción, es fuego de puro amor, es palomo, palomar, olivo del olivar, es el canto universal, cadena que hará triunfar el derecho de vivir en paz. La, 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 es el canto universal, cadena que hará triunfar el derecho de vivir en paz, el derecho de vivir en paz.
When I feel alone, I sing. Happy birthday to me. Today's my birthday. No, not today is the day of my birth, but today is the day of my rebirth, because every day that I do this poem, I reemerge from within this womb of myself, and I'm alone. The same way I'm going to die. Alone. But hopefully, not lonely. See, I want the few who do and will know me to know that life knew how to hold me, and that I died in her arms right where I belonged. Embracing, discovering every fold of skin one can get lost in, the cost is I will have to do it alone. The same way we all dream. And really, would it be any clearer if I said God wrote a letter saying truth is, Deanna, I gotta go. Because there's over 7 billion people that need directions or a miracle, and that's only on this earth. And what about the universe and the unimaginable amount of animals you could imagine don't believe in me? And there's a million more forests that need more rings, because life is getting engaged to trees. And there's 200,000 more leagues into the sea that I got to keep a secret. Because honestly, I see you all as destructive creatures. And there's plants I got to protect so this world will have what it needs to heal it. I am not forsaking you. No, I am not your father whose heart will be in heaven. Hallowed be thy silent shame. I'm just leaving you my spirit and free will, understanding there'll be days you curse my name. So you take care while I'm gone. Find my voice and yours to keep you strong, and I'll leave your life with teachers who will inspire you and remind you of what I can do, and that words are more than a sound or sounds forming meaningful elements of speech. They are powerful tools to reach those like you who are of this state of solitude, a place where when you blink, it's just you behind the eyelids. If I said this, would that help you to get this message that life is a revolving door system? You're born alone. You struggle to connect because this life hurts. It hurts like being considered 3/5 of a human being. Tattooed identification, deaf ears, and assassinations. Like bloody broom handles. Like empty yet distended stomachs. Like emptied, then reloaded, then reloaded, then reloaded clips. Like unsolicited long journeys. And goodbyes, like concrete beds and cardboard sheets, like ghettos, like glue in paper bag, track marks, stray bullets and landmines, the Willie Lynch plan, like being orphaned, like women and children being raped, like land being auctioned, having to sell yourself, like closets and hate. This life hurts like a broken heart. And then you die alone. Sound about right? Who here hasn't caught themselves asking, God, what's your problem? Why are we faced with such plights? But there is no reply, because he knows that we know that if we are to keep this communication through the darkness, it's going to come through continuous communication and unity equaling community. Mesh fingers, rallies, and sincere apologies. Through head bobs, hugs, and how was your days? Through I love yous. Sun settings and smiles. Through hope. And the end will justify the means if you, if I, can echo, you are not alone, alone. To your reflection and mean it. Don't you agree? Don't you want to be a part of something, fit in somewhere not inside the box or on the fence, but somewhere in between? If so, when you feel alone, sing. Happy birthday to me. With me. Because to die alone could be done with ease, but to live together requires work. Work that cannot be done alone.
You're listening to Back in the USSR here on 93.3 FM, CFRU. That was a good poet friend of mine, Truth Is, her poem, Alone, which is a poem that's always really spoken to me, you know, especially that ending. The last few ending lines are just remarkable in that poem. It's like, you know, to die alone can be done with ease, but to live together requires work. Work that cannot be done alone. And that really sums up a lot of what I was talking about in the first part of this show, you know, where it's like, you know, to counter gender-based violence, you know, we really need community. We need trust. We need, you know, all these things. We need to build those things up. We need to, like, really, you know, care for one another. You know, that's the way we counter this stuff. That's the way we take a stand here. And of course, before the poem, we had Victor Jara with El Derecho de Vivir en Paz, the right to live in peace, which, of course, all women have. They have the right to live in peace, the right to live in safety, the right to live in dignity. And all those things are things that have to be defended, have to be upheld. And, you know, as male allies, such as myself, like we have to take a stand as well. And we have to, like, fight for those things. So, speaking of male allyship, the next part of the show, what I want to do is I want to play a talk by Michael Parenti, who, of course, is a, you know, really, really solid Marxist author and scholar. And he also takes this issue very seriously. He takes women's rights very seriously. He has always tried to stand up and be an ally in any way he can. And this is the talk that he gave quite a few years ago now, but which cuts to the heart of a lot of the things I was talking about at the beginning of the show. And even the title kind of really, really says it all about, like, the kind of things we're up against. Like, the title of this talk is Male Terrorism and the Political Economy of Gender-Based Violence. Right? Because what I was saying before, like, gender-based violence is built into capitalism, feudalism, slavery, all these kind of, like, oppressive systems that we've had in human society and human history. You know, from the ancient world to the present day. And this is what we're up against. This is what we're trying to tear down. This is what revolutionary societies in the 20th century, like, worked so hard to tear down and won incredible gains, you know, for the rights of women in the process, and encouraged change all over the world and, like, advancement of women in other societies as well. So that's what I want to round out the show in. So I'm going to turn it over here to Michael Parenti. Please stay tuned to Back in the USSR.
Good evening. Our speaker tonight, Michael Parenti, has the rare ability to combine scholarship with activism. His analysis of our society's cultural and social institutions points out how they have propagated images and themes that support militarism, imperialism, racism, sexism, authoritarianism, and other undemocratic values. He further discusses how these societal inequities serve the purpose of the political economic elites. Also, the clarity of Michael Parenti's analysis gives you the confidence and inspiration that you can understand the history of social development. He continually provides examples in history where battles for social justice have been won, often with great difficulty. It gives us all a sobering sense of responsibility to preserve and protect these social gains and to further the progress of true democratic rights. Dr. Parenti received his PhD from Yale University and has written 9 books, including Democracy for the Few, A Critical Study of the Entire U.S. Political Economic Order, another book, Inventing Reality, The Politics of the Mass Media, demonstrates how and why the news is distorted, and a third book, The Sword and the Dollar, Imperialism, Revolution, and the Arms Race, is an important critique of U.S. imperialism and its brutal counter-revolutionary policy. I should also like to mention that Parenti's work stands the test of time. Democracy for the Few, originally published in 1974, is now in its 5th edition. As you could see when you came in, many of Parenti's talks are available on both audio and videotape. People's Video, based here in Seattle, sells these tapes at cost. We're recording tonight's talk, so sign up at the table if you are interested. Michael Parenti's latest book will be published next month. It is entitled Land of Idols, Political Mythology in America. In this book, he argues that our political culture and dominant ideology is riddled with mythologies that serve conservative class interests. His talk tonight is adapted from one chapter of this book on the victimization of women. Please join me now in welcoming Michael Parenti.
Thank you very much. I'm not known for being at the cutting edge of feminist work. Most of the women's struggle in recent years, as you know, almost all of it has been waged, launched, organized, fought by women, and defined, and much of the theory also has been developed. And that is, as it should be, that it's time for women to be doing the talking and men to listen. I noticed in recent years, though, people were saying to me, why don't you write something about the women's struggle? And I pleaded a division of labor, although in Democracy for the Few, the very first edition, 74, it was the only study in American politics that actually, it was the first one, I should say, that actually had stuff on women in the law, women in voting, and a number of other things, the struggle of women in it. But I never saw myself as someone who should be doing that, and that it was very important for women to be doing it. I've changed my view because I think it's very important for men to be giving attention to this subject, because the women's problem is men, you know. The women's struggle involves men, and men have to really be actively thinking and joining in that struggle and continuing to listen. Well, I'll begin with a question that was asked by Sigmund Freud. He said, what does woman want? It's a very famous question that's been used again and again, usually ironically. And after listening for decades to the tormented histories of his female patients, Freud the patriarch still wasn't sure what they wanted. Now, what women want is what most of us want, the opportunity to live decent, fulfilling, loving, and secure lives. And before all that, women want something else. They want to stop being oppressed and victimized by men. And they also want to stop being victimized by the social order that has been created. It may not just be a particular man, but it may be a patriarchal social order. In most societies, women have been relegated to subordinate positions. Endowed with a denser musculature, larger frames, greater body strength, men have not been above using their physical strength to enforce their superordination. In addition, you know, women have been burdened by a protracted pregnancy period, protracted lactation, and often the dependency of children on women have often made women dependent on others. Such biological differences might make male supremacy possible, but not inevitable. I mean, they're a necessary condition for abuse, but not a sufficient cause. Not every male mistreats women. I mean, all adults are stronger than children, but not every adult abuses children, although we find there are a lot more than we had thought. Other conditions have to obtain. According to one theory, much of a patriarchy gets more widely established as a real cultural and social force with the advent of surplus property. That is, when you move from early tribal subsistence society to developed horticulture society, you get surplus. With surplus, you get possessions and such. In the early hunting societies, for instance, there was an early horticulture. There was a relatively non-possessive enjoyment of children, a non-exploitative relationship between mates. Generally, I don't want to idealize these societies, over-idealize them. There was no private property other than personal effects and utensils and weapons, things like that. And women often played a surprisingly prominent role. Morgan's classic study of the Iroquois society, of ancient society, which very much impressed Engels, you know, one of the discoveries was how the Iroquois women played a dominant role in the decision-making councils and the like. With the emergence of more developed horticulture and the advent of landed property, private profit was now possible. Family lineage and identity and possession gets tied to land and to wealth. The labor of women and children itself becomes a source of accumulation. There are some early theorists like Osborne Ward who says the first practices of slavery began in the patriarchal family were affected on women and children by the patriarch, which shows you the confluence of gender and class oppression right from an early start. Women themselves become possessions in that kind of system. Their labor and sexuality becomes controlled in the service of profit and family and property and marriage. With class society comes the whole-scale subjugation of women. That's one of the theories. And I think it's a pretty fair approximation. I'm not saying it can't have some redoing in it and whatever else, but it makes a lot of sense. I would also argue something else, more immediate, that people exploit other people because they get something from it. They benefit from it. It's advantageous to them. Whether you are the plantation owner who has slaves, or the feudal lord who has serfs, or you're the male who's exploiting women, or you're the boss who's exploiting workers, there's a reason you do it, and it's not because you're kind of hung up and you're not in touch with your inner feelings and you can't cry. It's because you like it, you enjoy it, you get a lot of good things. You live very well from it. You live very well off the labor of others. And I would say that female subjugation exists because it has worked to the advantage of males. It's a rather unpresupposing proposition. I mean, and yet it's amazing how people get startled that it works to the advantage of males. I mean, it's important to say that because today there's a lot of talk about how men are victimized by their own sexism. They cheat themselves out of mutually gratifying relationships. That in the long run would be better for them if they didn't do these things. Maybe so, but nobody lives in the long run. They all live in the here and now. And in the here and now, we mustn't overlook the fact that patriarchal dominance provides its own gratifying privileges. The traditional patriarch has women who do all the drudgery work and child rearing, who tend to his personal needs, submit to his sexual desires, do not question his right to extramarital indulgences, are economically dependent on him, who supplement the social production and even the family income, provide subsistence labor, unpaid, much of it important and totally unpaid, and who have no defense against his tyrannical commands and his more corrupt impulses. The husbands, fathers, and employers who have reaped the benefits of this victimization over the centuries and to this day have not noticeably complained about feeling deprived of the deeper gratifications that come with gender equality, no more than have the pimps who live lavishly off the labor of their victimized prostitutes. Male dominance, I think, extends beyond the family into other social institutions. Just like racists, just like class oppressors, the male supremacist develops an array of myths to justify their advantages. Oh, what do you have, a conspiracy about this too, Parenti? I mean, you think they sit there and they consciously say, oh, how can we keep women in their place? Well, yes, Yes, yes. Read Ann Jones' book. She has a very delightful preface, a book called Women Who Kill, and she says, all the literature in this field takes pains to say, I'm not positing a conspiracy theory. This is just the cultural mores, is something that just kind of happened, and inertia, beloved. They all make pains to say, well, I'm not saying that men have consciously conspired. She said, I want to say men have consciously conspired. All you got to do is deal with the law, deal with the police, deal with the political structure, deal with Orrin Hatch, deal with these people. Are you telling me there's no conscious conspiring? You're sitting there watching these guys on TV? Yes, of course they consciously. How do you think people maintain hegemony? How do you think they consciously think of how they can keep you in your place? They're thinking just as hard as feminist fighters and revolutionaries are thinking how to get out of it. And they have a lot more resources in many cases. So like the racists and like the class oppressors, the male supremacists developed this whole array of myths through the ages. Female subordination has been treated as a manifestation of the natural order of things. By the way, that is the common trait of all these oppressions. If you read the feudal lords, they will tell you the serfs naturally belong there. That is their place. It's the way it is. The Chinese landlord class used to have the phrase, the sun cannot rise in the west. And it meant that you peasants could no more change places with me or hope to better your life than you could expect the sun to rise in the west. It just doesn't happen. That this is all part of the natural order of things. And to develop that, they enlist folklore, religion, philosophy, science, literature. I mean, the way science has been enlisted in the support of racism, for instance, as you know. Just reading George Templeman Strong, you know, the patrician in the 19th century, who was saying, it's amazing, we have black people who are running businesses, writing literature, organizing organizations for their liberation, doing this, doing that, and this. But science comes in with a precision, a commanding precision, to tell us that they are incapable of doing these things, and we must listen to science. Even though science has been changing its hypotheses for the last 25,000 hypotheses that they've had. I'm not making it up. This is what he said, and it was kind of interesting to hear that from a, you know, uptight New England patrician to have that awareness of the pretensions of science being rolled out here to tell us who should be in what place. Literature, philosophy, I said. Aristotle, 2,000 years ago or more, tells us, 2,450 years ago, quote, so is it naturally with the male and the female. The one is superior, the other inferior. The one governs, the other is governed. It was all very self-evident to Aristotle. Holy Scripture, the Bible, is wonderful, if you're looking for quotes on this. It reveals that God is not only a male, but a male supremacist. Genesis 3:16, thy desire shall be to thy husband. But I suffer not, no, let the woman learn in silence with all subjection. But I suffer not a woman to teach, nor to usurp authority over the man. Now, it's a very interesting thing that if that's your natural place, it's very interesting, it's your natural place, it's the natural order, it's very congruent and confluent, yet they're always telling you, just stay there, don't you try to get out of line. And I mean, why are you so worried about it, Timothy? If they are naturally there, why are you worried that they're going to outdo you, outshine you, outperform you, and not be under as they should? Feminist protest and rebellion, as you know, is not new. There's a famous letter I'm sure many of you have read, written in 1776, a letter to her famous husband, John Adams, written by Abigail Adams, who urged that the laws of the new nation shall, quote, remember the ladies and not put such unlimited power into the hands of the husbands. Remember, all men would be tyrants if they could. Why then not put it out of the power of the vicious and the lawless to use us with cruelty and indignity? And she's using some pretty strong terms here about male-female relations. She's talking about the vicious and the lawless to use us with cruelty and indignity. She's alluding to some very real things that are happening, forms of abuse and the like. in a manner that's, by the way, reminiscent of all privileged individuals. And I saw this, I mean, if you're talking about serfs, you're talking about Aristotle, you're talking about the Greek patriarchal ruling class, you talk about the industrial bosses, the capitalists, whatever else. All in all cases, they have the same trait, and John Adams did the same thing. He responded by using a technique that is very, very common. You'll see it all through history. He simply reversed the roles of victim and victimizer. And he wrote back to Abigail as follows. As to your extraordinary code of laws, I cannot but laugh. We men have only the name of masters and will not give up this, which would completely subject us to the despotism of the petticoat. You see, he is suffering from the despotism of the petticoat. So they consciously know where their interests lie. In the 19th century, political leaders, educators, and clergy thought females were creatures of emotion and innately unqualified to vote. You remember, for women struggled for the vote, and in our pluralistic, open, flexible, evolving system, they had to struggle for a mere 100 years, and they got the vote, just like that. I mean, just got up there, and it took only 100 years of getting beaten and jailed and force-fed in prisons and all that, and then they got the vote. So what are you complaining about? Okay. Women really weren't qualified for the vote, and this was a big issue in the 19th century, all through. I mean, incredible outpouring of literature about why women couldn't vote. They were too emotional. They were physically infirm. Speaking for many males of his day, one minister referred to, quote, the logical infirmity of mind, which constitutes one of the weaknesses, and I might also say one of the charms of the feminine constitution, unquote. It was said that women voters would forfeit their right to chivalry's protections if they voted. They could best inspire their men toward the virtuous life by remaining above politics rather than wallowing in it, you see. That they were very moral, and being moral, they would not be able to learn the arts of compromise and moderation. That's an interesting point there. Suffrage also would cause them to forego marriage and motherhood and succumb to the temptations of free love and socialism. Oh, I wish it were true about socialism. Furthermore, this is probably the most common prognosis, the turbulence of political life would be too taxing on a woman's delicate nature and health. And in considering the frailty of women, of course, these anti-suffragists had to overlook the many, many working-class women who stood from dawn to dusk toiling at factory looms 10, 12 hours a day. They overlooked the women who put in endless days at stoop labor picking crops in a hot field. Or the women who worked 70-hour weeks sewing garments in fire-trap sweatshops. And by the way, subsequent events demonstrated that even the most fragile, the most delicate of the upper-middle-class ladies proved hardy enough to withstand the rigors of walking into a polling booth and casting a ballot. They were able to do it without one recorded instance of any one of them fainting. The mode of gender oppression often varies according to class and race. Some bourgeois feminists are indifferent or overtly hostile to the recognition of class differences and class conflict. The same Abigail Adams, who so rightly argued women's cause, expressed an unlimited hostility toward the farmers of Western Massachusetts, who, when they were facing ruinous taxes, foreclosures, all sorts of oppressions, being thrown into debtor's prison and the like, they took up arms, an armed rebellion in America in 1787 known as Shays' Rebellion. And in a letter to Thomas Jefferson, Abigail Adams denounced Shays' Rebellion, quote, ignorant, restless desperados without conscience or principles have led a deluded multitude to follow their standard under pretense of grievances which have no existence but in their imaginations. Talking about the poor women and men who challenge her class interests, she sounds like John Adams talking to her when she argues for women's rights. Continuing, some of them were crying out for a paper currency, some for an equal distribution of property, unquote. She went on to call for, quote, the most vigorous measures to quell and suppress these mobbish insurgents who dared to rebel against the propertied class. I'm sorry, these mobbish insurgents, unquote. I then added, who dared to rebel against the property class, and who dared, in her words, to argue for, her words, an equal distribution of property, which I said a minute ago. Now, that was her position, not because she was a woman, because there were women actively involved in Shay's rebellion. There were women, farmers' wives, who were out there, you know, loading the muskets and fighting and standing in front of the courthouses and opposing the debtors' prison. There were women in that fight, too. She opposed that because of her class. Similarly, the French novelist George Sand, who defied 19th century conventions, you know, she smoked little cigars and she wore men's clothes, and she demanded equality for women. But she denounced the revolutionary women and men of the Paris Commune, and the women played a very prominent role in the Paris Commune. Les incendiaries, you know, they were out there causing the fires and all that right out on the battlefront. She denounced them, those who fought against the class privilege she herself enjoyed. Quote, "The mob is composed in part of dupes and fools, in part of the most degraded and criminal elements of the population. Nothing but a lot of coarse clowns." That's a terribly insensitive way to talk about people who are fighting, putting their lives on the line because of oppressive economic conditions. So when push came to shove, the otherwise iconoclastic Georges Sand showed her bourgeois colors and her class bigotry, demonstrating once again that wearing pants is no guarantee of wisdom or fairness. In 1908, the labor militant Clara Zetkin sharply criticized, quote, "a great and very influential portion of the English women's writers who oppose the legal protection of female labor." Anne Sullivan, the teacher of the famous Helen Keller, criticized the Boston Brahmin women who advocated female suffrage and abolitionism, and yet they treated their Irish servant girls like dirt. Mother Jones repeatedly made the same argument about the same particular stratum of women. Which doesn't mean that their fight for equal rights within their particular class boundaries was not a legitimate fight and an important democratic gain. I don't want to make that point, that that's an irrelevant issue. Because through the 19th century, in most states of the Union, women could not hold office or vote. They could not sit on juries. They were barred from medical schools, law schools, postgraduate training, either by law or custom. They didn't have legal custody of their own children, or legal ownership of their own earnings, or any other property, or any inheritance. But if a woman got an inheritance from her father, he died, it became her husband's property. Anything acquired before or during the marriage, these all became the husband's. The point I'm making, the fight for legal equality, that fight which involved these Boston Brahmin women, all these other women, that was a very important and very real and legal fight. But it was a limited fight, because for millions of female wage workers who owned no property, they had no hope of inheritance, they had no hope of a higher education, they had no hope of going to law school. Such grievances were, and by the way, such grievances still are not the most urgent ones. Today, low-income women are far more heavily burdened by toil, drudgery, want, and illness than women or men of more affluent means. They enjoy far fewer, if any, opportunities for travel, advanced education, leisure, creative work, career advancement, and financial independence. They have less access to good maternal and medical services and child care. As one class-conscious white feminist put it, quote, "working class life is demeaning, not because its culture or values are inferior, but because of the lack of money, lack of opportunity, lack of job responsibility, lack of respect, lack of power. In short, because of oppressive treatment of the working class by the higher classes," unquote.